Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility now presents The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, featuring interviews with leading change makers from around Vermont and around the world. It's underwritten in part by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. The UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. National Life Group, which lives its values every day. Do good, be good, make good. By Coffee World, your local digital print shop offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power, as well as over 750 VBSR businesses.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation. This week we spend the hour with author Andrew Solomon. Solomon is a PhD and a writer and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology. He is a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center and president of the Pan American Center. Solomon's 2012 book, the best-selling Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, tells the stories of families raising exceptional children who not only learn to deal with their challenges, but also find profound meaning in doing so. Far From the Tree has received the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction, the J. Anthony Lucas Award, and numerous other awards. Andrew Solomon has a new book out. It's called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years, which collects his writings about places undergoing seismic shifts, political, cultural, and spiritual, from the barricades in Moscow in 1991 to the rubble of Afghanistan in 2002 to the cautious optimism of Myanmar in 2014, Andrew Solomon provides a unique view into some of the most crucial social transformations of the past quarter century. Andrew Solomon, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
What a pleasure to be here.
Your career straddles many disciplines, journalism, psychology, travel literature, the arts. Can you talk about the trajectory of your career and how it has woven all these disciplines together?
Well, I started off writing about artists and really writing more about the artists than about their art. So, of course, I was writing about both with the belief that often when you go into faraway societies, there's a need to engage with kind of an intelligent, informed population that can often be overlooked. Then I myself got depressed and wrote a book about depression that kind of grew out of that. Over time, I've come to feel that there's a complementary nature to these things. In the first place, I feel like the travel and the international reporting is all about an opening out, and depression is about a closing in. But more fundamentally, all of the work is really about resilience. It's about strength of character. It's about people's capacity to take circumstances which look from the outside like they're very painful and debilitating and turn them into the locus of some kind of profound meaning. And that runs through the Far From the Tree, in which I talk to families of children with disabilities and other differences. It runs through the depression work, and it runs through the international reporting, much of it from places where people's lives are extremely difficult.
So in all of these, what came first? You mentioned the arts was where you began. Is that correct?
Yes. My first published story out in the real world was for Art Forum many, many, many years ago now. And then I was an arts correspondent for British philosophy magazine called Harper's and Queen, and I sort of found myself going deeper and deeper into the art world. I thought ahead of time that I might be focused more specifically on literature, but there were two drawbacks. One is that I'm not great at languages and didn't have all the languages that would be needed to read literature in them. But the other is that if you're writing about international literature, mostly people mail you a book. And if you're writing about international art, you go and see the art in the place where it is. And I really wanted to go to places and to expand my horizons. And art became an interesting locus for that exploration.
How did that morph into covering the kinds of upheavals that you chronicle in your latest book, Far and Away?
Well, I started off writing about artists in Moscow during the end of the Soviet Union, though, of course, I didn't know that it was the end of the Soviet Union yet. And after I had published my first book, which was about those artists and the way their lives changed during Glasnost and with the opening out of possibilities in their country, I went back to visit them, thinking that I had finished writing about them and I would just go back for a social visit. And I was there during the putsch in which right-wing extremists took over the Kremlin, kidnapped Gorbachev, and tried to bring about, you know, a military state again. And the artists were among the people who organized the resistance to that coup. And I was struck that these artists had spent so many years saying that they were trying to keep the idea of truth alive in a society in which truth itself was being annihilated, and that they were doing so out of this deep idealism. I had wondered what that idealism would be like when put to the test, and it was put to the test, and I understood that though these artists didn't individually bring about the end of that coup, they were among those who prevented it from succeeding. And I was deeply moved by that. And I thought, I wonder what else people have to think or say in order to propel their society through the next crossroads of its history. And I set out really to investigate that. It spread out from the experience in Moscow and from the experience of these exquisitely articulate artists who were willing to stand up to the tanks when the time came to do so.
So this was completely by chance that you were there when this attempted coup happened?
Yes. I mean, nobody knew about the coup ahead of time. It would not have been a coup if they had. I mean, I was there. I thought I was having a nice, relaxing time. I was supposed to have dinner with a friend. The phone rang, and she said, I'm sorry, I can't make dinner tonight because Gorbachev is kidnapped and maybe the whole country will be engulfed in the revolution. And I said, oh, Russians are always so melodramatic, and I went back to bed. And then when I got up a little bit later, it turned out that there actually was a coup going on and that the country was teetering at the brink of some kind of revolution. And I always remember on the third day of that coup going with a couple of the artists to see the place where people had been shot the night before near Smolenskaya. And we were all standing around, and then this young guy clutching a kind of tweed cap and looking like a character from a Chekhov play came running up to us and said, there are tanks approaching the barricade. Come and defend the barricade. And we'd heard that on various occasions, and mostly there really weren't tanks. We sort of sauntered up, and we arranged ourselves in front of the barricades, and 2 minutes later, a column of tanks rolled up. And I thought, this is not what I signed up for when I set out to be an art critic. But the tanks rolled up, and the soldier on the front tank said, we have unconditional orders to destroy this barricade. If you'll get out of the way, we don't need to hurt you. But if you won't, we'll have no choice but to run you down. And the artist said, give us just a minute. Give us just 1 minute to tell you why we're here. And they launched into this fluent defense of democracy that most of us who live in a democracy would be incapable of mustering. And they said, you don't remember what the darkest days of oppression were like. Let us tell you what they were like. They were terrible. And they spoke with such passion and such conviction. And when they finished, the soldier just sat there silently, with his arms crossed over his chest. And he looked down at us, and we were wet, and we were bedraggled. It was raining, and we were a pretty miserable little group, and certainly no one to stand up to tanks. But after he looked at us for a good minute, he said, what you have said is true, and we must bow to the will of the people. If you'll clear some space for us, we'll turn our tanks around and we'll leave you your barricades. And it was in that moment that I thought the ability to describe freedom can often be the best path to obtaining or sustaining freedom. It's not just a kind of interesting philosophical exercise. It matters in the deepest possible way.
You know, Americans, in our political system, we have never seen this kind of organized revolt on a national scale. We've seen it certainly in urban uprisings, whether it's in Ferguson with Black Lives Matter and other places where, you know, urban riots. What does it feel like to be in a country like the Soviet Union in this state of, you know, high tension where you don't know what tomorrow will bring?
Well, I mean, I've had versions of that experience, not only in the Soviet Union, but in Afghanistan and in Libya and in Myanmar and in a number of the other places that I've reported from and that are in the book. It's a very heady feeling. It's the sense, it's terrifying, of course, because everything could go horribly wrong, but it's also unbelievably exhilarating. The sense that things are changing has great value, and one of the points I make in the book is that the sense that things are changing has great value, even if in the end things don't change, because I think often change occurs after hope's multiple inceptions. Often it is not until over and over again the gesture toward freedom has failed that it finally arrives. And some of the places I wrote about aren't that much more free than they were when I first went there. I mean, Putin's Russia is not a fiesta of liberalism. On the other hand, South Africa, where I reported, for all of the problems that there have been with the ANC government, it's a very different and much better place than it was before the ANC came to power. So I think it's a moment of people feeling both thrilled and terrified is the short answer.
What made you decide to write your latest book, Far and Away? It's an ambitious thing. You're not at the end of your career. You're in the middle, but you're really taking a big, long look back. The subtitle, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. What inspired this?
Well, partly I had a kind of general sense that I had gone to a lot of places and that what I'd seen added up to more than the pieces did by themselves. Partly I really think that we live in a time in which there is a lot of work being done to stir up xenophobia. There's a lot of talk about building a wall between us and Mexico. There's a lot of talk about the things that are foreign being automatically threatening. I mean, to some degree, that rhetoric set in with 9/11 and has continued from there, but it's escalated dramatically in this presidential race. And I think that circling the wagons and trying to block out globalism is both impossible and would be a mistake if it were possible. So I think that we live in a world in which what happens everywhere affects what happens everywhere else. I think it's important to acknowledge that about the world. I think it's also really crucial to say to people, these societies that you think of as so foreign, so alien, so impossible, actually contain people who are a bit like you. And we've lived in an era in which people place a lot of emphasis on depth of knowledge, and I believe in depth of knowledge. But I think it's often meant that people become expert in only one thing or only one place. You know, they're sinologists or they're Kremlinologists or they're Africanists or whatever they are. They're very narrowly focused. And I wanted to say I've gone to many places. I've engaged with them deeply. It's not that I've sort of just run across the surface. There are some insights that come not from going to one place over and over again, but from going to many places. And in a globalized world, the ability to describe those interactions among cultures seems to me to be crucial.
We're talking with the author Andrew Solomon. He is the author most recently of the book Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. He's also the author of a number of previous books, notably Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You can join this conversation by calling us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Going back to the present American political situation, as you've just referenced, you've been in the unique position, you know, in the United States, we've had this two-party with occasional independent party, competitions for a very long time. But you've seen much more dramatic political forces at work in your travels, the rise of far-right and neo-Nazi groups in Europe. And now there is talk among many, as we see the rise of people like Donald Trump building walls, the xenophobia, that it's starting to look a lot more like some of the places you've written about. Is there a place that comes to your mind a lot as you listen to the current political discourse? What's it remind you of from where you've traveled?
Well, I mean, I think we are in a position in which we could end up with a much more repressive society. One of the things that I'm struck by actually is not particularly about this presidential race, but it's about the increasing level of surveillance. That when I was in the Soviet Union, people would say to me, oh, this is a conversation we shouldn't have on the phone. I'll meet you in person and we'll go for a walk where they won't be able to tape us and so on. And I dealt a lot with people who were dealing with the sense of an intrusive government. And now, you know, people are finding themselves not able to be fully expressive in email, for example, because they know that their emails could get brought up in court at some point in the future. And with the whole question of telephone, phone tapping and so on, people have become wary to some degree of speaking to one another by phone. So I think the intrusion of surveillance has really been acute. And I think the other thing is that when we look at the possibility of a significant shift in leadership, I started off thinking that at some level that freedom and justice were what everyone wanted, and that if you took away all the impediments, those were the things that would arrive. I thought about Libya. I was in Gaddafi's Libya. It was the worst place there could possibly be, and I thought it can only get better. But in fact, when Gaddafi fell, there was no one to take his place, and what follows on the demise of an absolutist ruler is not a reversion to democracy, but a reversion to chaos. And the chaos in Libya has been really poisonous. And I think that when you have a significant shift from a leader who is adept and competent, as I believe the current president is, to the possibility of a president who would not be so adept and competent, I think that becomes a concern. I think it's surprisingly easy for a society to fragment and to become chaotic and to go entirely to pieces.
Well, there's that image of going into chaos. There's the other of drifting into authoritarianism. And it seems a lot of the current political dialogue hints at the latter, a kind of authoritarian drift. Does that strike you that way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think frequently what you get is a period of chaos, and then chaos is so intolerable because people really want security more than they want democracy or even wealth. They want security. You have a period of chaos, and then an autocrat comes along who's able to take over and become the authoritarian leader, and the chaos gives way to authoritarianism. I think it's a very natural progression from one to the other.
I'm curious, because you have seen so many different societies in different stages of this spectrum that you're describing, from chaos to authoritarianism, where do you locate the United States right now, where we are seeing political forces or players rise up, certainly with Trump, we're talking about, this sort of angry, dispossessed, middle-class white male is often described as the classic Trump follower. So where do you locate us in this spectrum?
Well, I think that the United States remains, a great democracy, and that essentially it's, as countries go, a reasonably fair and just one. There are aspects of the system that I think aren't working very well. I could talk all day about problems that there are in the U.S., but in comparison to places like Libya or Afghanistan or Russia or China, it's a more open society and a more inclusive society. So I would have that as a kind of jumping off point. But I think the populism that has led to the rise of Trump, and that has led in some ways also to the rise of your state senator Bernie Sanders, the sense of anger and disillusionment that voters have expressed, and the wish to have everything radically transformed in one direction or the other, really is the outgrowth of the breakdown of social mobility. And I think social mobility has broken down in part because the education system has been neglected, in part because of the way the tax laws got restructured to allow the very rich to get ever richer, which seems to be connected to the poor getting ever poorer. I just think that when this country was in its real heyday, there were a lot of people who were realizing a kind of American dream and going from, if not from rags to riches, they were going from rags to a solid place in the middle class. And I think as those possibilities close down, people become very angry and very disillusioned, and you begin to have a society that feels unwieldy, in which there's sort of, the small elite of people who are privileged and this vast mass of people who are struggling and suffering. I think that the people who might best be able to resolve that are not always the ones who sound most radical from the stump. But I think there's a lot of this, really frightening populism that we see in which people are just there so upset with the whole structure of the society and they want it to change beyond recognition.
Do you think that America could drift into an authoritarian society such as the ones that you've covered?
You know, I have talked to a lot of German friends over the years who described how they laughed about that ridiculous guy Hitler when he started campaigning in Berlin and who then lived through the Nazi regime. I think that justice and civil society are more fragile than we mostly would like to believe. I don't think we'd become exactly like the other societies I've written about because I think there are different traditions and there's a different population. So I'm not going to say we'll end up exactly like a name someplace. Is there a risk that we could turn into an authoritarian society in which rather than having greater justice and freedom, injustice and lack of freedom being the engines of the change, we would actually see more injustice and more lack of freedom? I think that that is a really very distinct possibility.
You know, I covered South Africa under apartheid at one point and sort of its progression, you know, to a democracy. And, you know, the term the banality of evil would often come to mind, where good people doing bad things. And where do you feel like you've seen that in your travels? You have written about Russia, China, South Africa, Cambodia. You've been all over the world. But do you feel like you've come face-to-face with that?
Come face-to-face with?
Well, the notion of where you have people constructing elaborate mythologies for themselves to essentially do very bad things to
The banality of evil.
Yes,
I do. I think it happens over and over again. I mean, the place where I felt I came the closest to the greatest evil was in Rwanda, because while I was in other countries in which I thought people had had misguided ideals or in which people had been authoritarian, the sort of level at which the ordinary citizens of the country were whipped up into a frenzy in which they quite willingly went and hacked up their neighbors with machetes was unlike anything that I had ever encountered. And the scars it had left in that society were so profound and so significant, so really overwhelming, and I was acutely aware of them. Evil is, on the one hand, banal. It's not glamorized. It's frequently tolerated by a large citizenry. I mean, I felt in apartheid South Africa, not that most of the white people I met were evil, because most of the white people I met were actually very much inclined to dismantle the system and so on, but in the meanwhile, they were benefiting from it. And I thought it was a very tricky thing to say, I really hate this system, and then have your house staffed by people who were the victims of it. I don't know that there was another way to be in that place in that time, but it was sometimes disturbing to encounter. And that was a kind of tolerance that I think is often very banal. But I have to say the really great evil I've encountered is mostly pretty large and impressive. It mostly isn't banal. It's not necessarily inspired and exquisite in the way that I think the Nazis attempted to be, and that Hannah Arendt in coming up with that phrase was contravening. But I think there's often a sense that what is dark and what is sinister and what is powerful is agonizing to people. You can see that it's evil, you can see that it's terrible, you're nonetheless helpless when you're in its clutches. Certainly I felt that way in Gaddafi's Libya, certainly, which was, you know, one of the most repressive societies I've been in. I felt that way in Myanmar under the junta. I felt elements of that even in the sort of closing down of free speech in China.
We're talking with Andrew Solomon. He's a writer and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology, author of a new book, Far and Away. We're going to take a short break for the news and be back in just a few minutes to continue our conversation. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending the hour with Andrew Solomon, a writer and lecturer on politics, culture, and psychology, and a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center and the president of the Pan American Center. Solomon is the author in 2012 of Far From the Tree, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. And his latest book is Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. Andrew, your life, you only recently became got a PhD in psychology, is that correct?
Yes, in 2013, I think.
So what made you decide to do that? You've had a very long and illustrious career as a journalist. That's a departure.
Well, of course, I received the degree in 2013. I started working on it a long time before that. After the publication of The Noonday Demon, which was my book about depression, I found myself traveling to universities and appearing in various academic symposia and so on. And I was aware that my training was really in English. That was what I had studied as an undergraduate and when I did my master's degree afterwards. And that while I had a lot of ideas about psychology, I didn't necessarily have all of the background information that I thought would be useful to inform the journalism and the nonfiction writing that I was doing. So it was really mostly because I wanted to gain this greater expertise and to feel that I had a real grounding in the field that I had ended up writing about. It was also because I thought it would be nice to do some writing in which I was not considering an audience, and in which I was really writing in a very disciplined and focused way. I thought it would have an effect on the way that my other work proceeds. Not that the other work isn't disciplined and focused, but it doesn't conform to the same academic standards, and I thought rising to those academic standards would be valuable training. And finally, I thought the research I did for the PhD could ultimately inform another book, and indeed the next book I'm planning to write really has grown out of the doctoral research I did.
Okay, well, you're leaving us hanging there. What is the next book, the subject of it?
So the next book is a book about the changing nature of family. It's about working mothers. It's about stay-at-home dads. It's about gay families, it's about open adoption, single mothers by choice or otherwise, single fathers, and so on and so forth, really about the way in which we've expanded our notion of what makes family. And the PhD was about motherhood and about the way that women go through a shift in motherhood, not only by having a relationship with a new baby, but also by having a relationship with a new identity. And it made me very interested in the intersection of identity and family, and really led on toward this book, which will draw on. I did a long longitudinal study of a group of 24 women whom I interviewed once before the birth of a first child, once just afterwards, and then every 6 months going forward for the years that followed.
Do you see patients? Are you a practicing psychologist?
No, I'm not a practicing psychologist. I give a lot of advice, but I don't see any patients.
And do you not want to? Why is that? You don't have an interest in practicing psychology in that way?
Well, I haven't done clinical training, which I would need to do before I could actually go into practice. But also, I feel like my real interest is in writing and research. I think it would be kind of interesting for me to see patients, but I don't feel an enormous calling toward it, and I feel I shouldn't take it on unless I felt I could do more for patients in that way than I can by writing books, and I don't feel that.
So you are a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia. What do you teach?
Well, it's a research professorship, so it mostly allows me to do research there and to work through the Institutional Review Board at Columbia and so on and so forth. I have an affiliation with the LGBT programs there and have worked on trying to look at mental health issues for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. I have taught a lot about the material that was in Far From the Tree, really about difference, about the way in which our ideas of illness and identity overlap, trying to understand the reality that you can define something as a mental illness and 10 years later it can be defined instead as an identity, and trying to look at how people negotiate those changes and how doctors can take care to help patients who have a troubling illness, but not to damage patients who have what really should be a fully realized identity. So I've taught about the autism rights movement. I've taught about the emergence of transgender culture in the American mainstream. I've looked at all of those shifts.
a lot of your writing is autobiographical in nature, or at least connects with personal experiences that you have and have had. Talk a little bit about your own family, your life with your husband and children, and how that has influenced your work.
So my family, in the most condensed way I can describe it, my husband is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. My best friend from college had got divorced but wanted to have children, and so she and I decided to have a child. So we have a daughter who lives in Fort Worth with my best friend and now her male partner. And then John, my husband, and I decided we wanted a child who we were bringing up full-time in our own household. And so we have George, of whom I am the biological father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate was Laura, the lesbian mother of John's two biological children. So it's six parents of four children in three states. And as I've found in the world, there are people who are very responsive to this kind of an opening up of family, and there are people who are very resistant to it. I had grown up thinking, I think I'm really gay, but I want more than anything to have kids, but if I'm really gay, I probably can't have kids, and I felt like there was this terrible conflict that would never be resolved. And then as I was struggling with that, the world around me was changing, and gay people started having families, and I realized that my understanding of myself when I was younger as having this sort of terrible thing wrong with me had become instead part of what had made me who I was, and having the family I have has turned out to be, you know, the most rewarding experience of my life.
In the, you know, within your family where you have biological parents who, you know, and, you know, parents who are not living, you know, not in your own household, have there been things about that that have surprised you, complications, feelings that perhaps, you know, the egg donor feels, or describe, you know, you've traveled a road here that few people are familiar with. So what have you discovered?
You know, I have days of thinking we're really just like any other family. It only sounds different from the outside. And I have days of thinking actually the whole experience is quite different. And what I've come down to is that I really deeply believe that there should be equality for gay and straight families, or for the different kinds of families there are, but that equality is not the same thing as equivalence, that you don't have to say in order to have equality, it's all just exactly the same. You know, I think there are obvious complexities that are introduced in these situations. I see my daughter in Texas, Emma, and then I wish I saw her more, and then, you know, there's a lot of figuring out to do, and what is the role that I have in her life. I see her, you know, every month, and we have an incredibly close relationship, and we talk on the phone all the time, but I'm still not there in the household every day. And how do I balance that against my relationship with my son when I am in the household every day? And we love John's biological children, whom call us Daddy and Papa, just as the other children do, but we don't play as large a role in their life because they have two parents, their two moms, who are their legal parents and who determine everything. There's a lot of role invention that has to go on. Now, I would say that actually, even in ordinary straight couples, there's been a lot of role invention going on with you know, women who are working and with men who are mostly more involved in childcare than their fathers were. But I think there isn't quite as much of a radical having to define everything. And sometimes that process of defining is incredibly thrilling and exhilarating and feels unbelievably free. And sometimes it's sort of exhausting, and I think it would be easier if just sort of one of us were the mom, the other one were the dad, the kids were all here, and it were sort of defined the way it was in the 1950s, what everyone's role was and what they were supposed to do.
We're talking with the author Andrew Sullivan. He is the author most recently of the book Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, also the author of Far from the Tree, and he is a lecturer and a professor of clinical psychology at Columbia. I want to talk for a minute about Far from the Tree, which got a lot of acclaim, won many awards. Why did you write it, and explain the premise of it for people who may not be familiar with it?
Well, it's a book about how families respond to having children who are different from them in some way. And the origin of it really was that I was asked to write a piece for the New York Times Magazine, as more than 20 years ago now, about deaf culture. And I was very taken aback. I hadn't known there was such a thing as deaf culture, and I thought it was a disability, those poor people, they couldn't hear, what could we do for them? And then I went out into the deaf world, and I went to deaf theater, and I went to deaf clubs, and I went to the Miss Deaf America contest, and I did all of these things in which I was immersed in deaf culture, and I realized it really was a culture. And then I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that in most instances those parents had historically tried to get their children to fit in by placing a huge focus on lip reading and oral speech, and that many of those deaf people discover deaf culture in adolescence or thereafter when it comes as a great liberation to them. And I thought how similar that was to the experience of gay people who are mostly born to straight parents, who often try to pressure them in one way or another to conform to social norms. And then those gay children often, in discovering gay culture in adolescence or thereafter, find a great liberation in it. And then a friend of a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf, and the same issues began rising to the surface again. And I discovered that most dwarfs are born to parents of average height, and I thought, well, there is a real question here of what it's like to have a defining characteristic that is so foreign to your parents, and how do parents resolve around that, and how do people who are directly affected end up with a sense of identity? So the book deals partly with conditions that have been classed as disabilities, deafness, dwarfism, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, and so on. It also looks at prodigies whose families are just as overwhelmed and confused, if less sad, perhaps, than the parents in the other categories. I looked at families bringing up children conceived in rape. I looked at families of people who commit crimes, because I wanted to indicate that this shift in identity can have to do with someone's behavior or character, and not only with their biology. And I looked at the question of transgender rights, which has, of course, been galloping along in the period since then. And it really was an attempt to look at what happens when you witness the distinction between what I've called vertical identities that get passed down generationally within a family, and horizontal identities that have to be learned from a peer group. And the things I've just listed are all identities that are essentially learned from a peer group. And I wanted to see, why is it some families fall apart in the face of these things and others intensely draw together? Back to the question of resilience we discussed earlier.
And what did you find? What families survive, and what families disintegrate?
If you ask women who have recently had a child with a significant challenge or disability, do you think that you will be able to learn and grow from this experience? And then you go back to those families 2 years later, the women who said, yes, I think my this will be a meaningful experience, difficult but meaningful, had children who were doing much better than the families of women who said, no, this is a disaster and I can't see any positive side to it at all. I think taking that more positive view is something that is constructed. It's not just that some people are by nature more optimistic than others. I think you have to make a decision that that's what you're going to do. As one mother said to me, she said, people always give us these little sayings like, God doesn't give you any more than you can handle. But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And I came away from the book thinking, if you have a child who isn't really what you had in mind when you set out to have children, which of course at some level is the experience of all families, you have to make a decision that you're going to love the child you have and not the child you imagined. And you will need to, if you can, and not everyone can, and I don't mean it to sound judgmental, but if you are able to look at it and say, even though this isn't what I had in mind, it's going to lead me in interesting and worthwhile new directions. Even though this isn't what I wanted, I'm going to learn from it. Then you'll be much better able to tolerate the difference that exists in your child. And sometimes, simply by believing that and insisting on it, you will ultimately find a basis for communication that is more intimate and more profound than you would ever have imagined possible, and that remains inaccessible to many of the people who are railing against their fate.
And in the families that who fell apart in the face of a challenge with a child, what did you see there? What were some common themes for them?
Well, I saw a mixture of outrage at know, the world or at God or at whoever they held responsible for giving them the child they had, I often saw that they had felt defeated and overwhelmed. You know, some of the time they felt defeated and overwhelmed for external reasons too, like they should have had access to all kinds of services for this child, but they didn't know what the services were and they didn't know how to access them, and so they didn't receive those services and they were just overwhelmed and exhausted. I mean, it's tough. It's tough being already economically disadvantaged and dealing with these problems. Often there was an issue in which one parent actually had the sort of, I'm going to grow and learn from this point of view, and the other parent had the, this is sheer living hell point of view, and that could create a lot of rifts. You know, having children all together is stressful, joyous but stressful, and having children with a lot of these differences is more stressful. And so placed enormous stress on marriages that were already fragile. My finding, though, was that the families who fell apart didn't really understand that there was another option, that there was a way to be with these children and not fall apart. And so part of what my book was about was trying to say, okay, we've looked at some families that are falling apart, but look, these are all of the different ways there are to achieve resilience. This is the point of view you can hold, and you're allowed to be ambivalent. You don't have to just go sort of all wonderfully happy. I mean, there was the mother of a severely disabled boy who died tragically through caregiver neglect, who said at his funeral, "Let me bury here the rage I feel to have been twice robbed. Once of the child I wanted, and once of the son I loved." And I think the people who were able to entertain that double narrative were the ones who did the best. Not to say, you know, this is the best thing that could ever have happened to me, but to say, given that it's happened to me, I've found a way to engage with it.
That's remarkable. Is it, you write in Far From the Tree, as you mentioned, about families with children with autism, deafness, dwarfism, children of rape, schizophrenia, transgender. Is it possible to say, who do you feel faced the greatest challenge, or for whom was their situation the most challenging of those?
You know, they are challenging in different ways. I mean, I would say schizophrenia seems particularly thankless. There are people who have had really interesting experiences complex delusions, and there are people who, despite having schizophrenia, figure out how to manage it and lead lives of enormous worth and greatness. But the upside is a little harder to see than it is in some of the other categories. I mean, I ended up thinking that most of these conditions that get described as disabilities were in some ways less like disabilities than some of the situations like families of people who committed crimes. You know, I think families of people who have committed really devastating the felony crimes are mostly devastated by that. Most criminals are not born into criminal families. And so I think those families struggle. And I think part of the reason schizophrenia is so difficult is because of its late age of onset. So if you have a child with Down syndrome, you most likely know the day your child is born, or dwarfism. If you have a child who is autistic, you probably know by the time the child is 2 years old. If you have a child who's schizophrenic, you probably don't discover the schizophrenia until your child is nearly grown up, because the average age of onset is between 17 and 27. So you've gotten to know someone very well, and then this disease comes along and effectively robs you of a person to whom you'd formed a deep attachment. I think that's very difficult for parents, and I think it's part of the reason why the Mad Pride movement, which is a sort of, let's put a positive spin on schizophrenia movement, has not reached the heights of the autism rights movement or the deaf rights movement or even the physical disability rights movement.
One of your early books, as you've mentioned, was The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, which was your own personal account of struggles with depression. And you began, this began, I guess, with a 1998 New Yorker article that you wrote. You and we in the world have come a long way with depression since that time. Can you just sketch out your personal journey with this, and your insights on a topic that you've chronicled for a very long time.
Well, I mean, I think that I think depression remains an acute problem. The World Health Organization estimates that by 2020 it will be the leading cause of disability worldwide. My book was both an examination of my own depression and an attempt to look at depression in cultural and scientific terms. And I wanted to put to rest two ideas. One was the idea that depression is a modern Western middle-class experience. And I therefore looked at historical documents of depression. Hippocrates described it 2,500 years ago, almost exactly the way we do now. I looked at cultural models by looking at depression among the Greenlandic Inuit and depression among survivors of the Khmer Rouge and tribal rituals for the treatment of depression in West Africa. And I looked at depression across the class spectrum. But the other piece of my investigation was to try to understand what the nature of resilience was. Why was it that some people seemed to have what sounded, as they described it, like relatively mild depression, but were nonetheless totally disabled by it, while other people had what sounded, as they described it, like much more severe depression, but somehow had managed to have meaningful lives, at least in between their depressive episodes? And so I really wanted to look at that and to try to understand how is it that people get through this, and why do some people get through and some people don't get through, and what are the supports we could create that would allow for more people to survive their depression.
And in terms of your own experience of this, how would you characterize where you are at on that journey now?
Well, I have been unbelievably fortunate. I have lived in this time in history. I've had access to extremely good care, both medication and psychotherapy. And I have, in the time since I was depressed, married my husband, had a family, gained a lot of roots into the world that I didn't then have. But it still rears its head. I mean, something goes terribly wrong, or sometimes even when nothing in particular has gone terribly wrong, and it's back again. And I always think, oh, I thought I had this permanently under control. Okay, now what do I have to do? And because it's familiar, it's not as threatening as it used to be. And because of the medications and so on, it's also not as severe as it used to be. But managing depression is a lifelong task. It doesn't, you don't cure it. You you treat and control it. And treating and controlling it requires ongoing effort.
You have, through your writings, really lived your life out loud. Is there a downside to that?
Well, there is sometimes. I mean, I make the joke when I go back to the university I studied at, where students were obliged to read some of my work. I said, when I was an undergraduate here, I was really hoping that I would become the kind of great writer whose work was read by students. I said, when I imagined that, however, I was not imagining that they would be reading my memoir in their abnormal psych class. So there's a certain amount of, discomfort in that. But I think I had been closeted as a gay person, and when I finally came out in my early 20s, I felt like the burden of that secrecy had been so enormous and so poisonous for me, and I decided I was never going to be in that situation again. And when I was depressed, various people said to me, how can you go out and talk about it so readily? And, there were very difficult moments, but I just thought, I'm not now going to go and have some other secret that I'm carrying around with me all the time and thinking, does this person know? Is that person guessed? What if that person told that person? I just don't want to do it. I want to be out there. Now, sometimes, I get viciously attacked in the media or online for particular positions I've taken or for particular details of my life. I've been, met people who've sort of had mean things to say, but there are very few of those experiences in the grand sweep of things. Mostly, I find what living your life out loud does is to provoke a complementary intimacy from other people who open up and tell you about their lives. And as someone who studies psychology, that's the most fascinating thing that could happen to me.
Okay, well, Andrew Solomon is the author of, most recently, Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. I want to thank you for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, and that's it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all conversations at VermontConversation.com. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 for another Vermont Conversation. Thanks for listening.
This previous hour has been presented by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, featuring interviews with leading change makers from around Vermont and around the world. It's underwritten by The Alchemist, serving the greater Waterbury community and Vermont since 2003. By UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. By Vermont National Life Group, which lives its values every day. Do good, be good, make good. By Coffee World, your local digital print shop, offering quick design and printing services for projects of all sizes. By Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers on energy innovations while delivering clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. As well as over 750 VBSR businesses.
You're listening to locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM and Warren, FM 96.5 Barrie, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. We're serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond.
AP Radio News.